Are the parties ready?
We are indeed, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Phil Talmadge here representing James Hopkins, Jr. I'd ask to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time if I could. This is a case involving instructional error in a case of a vicious assault on...
We're aware of the facts.
Good.
Focusing on the three instructions that the court refused to give.
Correct.
It appears as though there is a correct statement of the well-established duty that was first set forth, I guess, in Briscoe and then picked up in McLeod, that a school district does have a special relationship with the students, and it has an obligation to or duty to protect them from reasonably anticipated dangers. So that language is picked up in these instructions.
Actually, it's not, Your Honor.
In your proposed instructions.
In our proposed instructions.
I want to just talk about your proposed
instructions. Yeah, in our proposed instructions, that's what we're picking up.
Well, you have that language, but
correct.
Then each of these instructions then has additional language that the court rejected, and there's discussion about why, and is arguably incorrect. So assume that these instructions do not, although they contain an amalgam of 10.01 and 10.02 and a special relationship, and then additional language that the court rejected is incorrect. Assuming that, did the court independently have an obligation to give an instruction on the special duty when it was not provided with an accurate statement of that? I mean, it's in here. You'd have to extrapolate it and then have a separate instruction that would simply say what I had previously recited.
I think the trial court does, Your Honor, for this reason.
Well, before you go on to for this reason, what case law supports that?
Well,
because if you look at all the cases, it's the refusal to give an instruction is abuse of discretion. You
correct.
Have the burden of proof to show prejudice.
Correct.
So, I mean, that's well established and repeated in all of these cases. So what case law says the court has an independent obligation to fashion an instruction that's not proposed that accurately states the
well,
duty?
Well, it has an obligation to correctly instruct the jury on the law. And what the court did here was it gave a generic vanilla instruction on negligence
with respect to the special relationship,
and then it's got its thumb on the scale in terms of the mainstreaming of this viciously assaultive
student. I agree with that, but I'm looking for support for the proposition that the court independently had an obligation to look at these proposed instructions and say, well, these are not an accurate statement of the law, but there is a sentence in here that is accurate, and if I look at McLeod and I look at Briscoe, I should give an instruction that just says this.
I don't think the trial court can sit idly by and give an instruction that it knows is an incorrect statement of the law.
Well, but
it's been given the core of the issue in the proposed instructions.
Well, but can the plaintiff idly sit by and not give an accurate instruction and then file an appeal asking for reversal, in effect, to get a new trial and give you the opportunity to propose a correct instruction?
Well, I would argue, first of all, Your Honor, that the proposed instructions were a correct statement of the law and the trial court was incorrect. But
well, which one? Because we've got three, and there are problems with each of them. So why don't you pick the one that you think is the most
accurate? I mean, proposed instruction number 8, the indication that there is a special relationship here.
It goes on then to add the statement from the intentional or criminal conduct of third parties. Was it undisputed that there was intentional criminal conduct in this case?
Well, intentional or criminal, there's little question that there was an assault that occurred here.
Right.
I mean, the student jumped on the back end of this young man, hit
well,
him in the back of the head.
Well, there was a lot of dispute about whether it was spontaneous or not. I mean, I agree with you, but
I get you there. But
was it undisputed that it was criminal conduct?
It was assaultive behavior, which is intentional conduct. I don't think that
Was it undisputed in the record that it was criminal?
Well, if the court struck criminal, then you've got the correct statement of the law. It was intentional conduct. It was an assault.
So you're saying essentially that the court has a duty to edit.
Well, the court has a duty to correctly instruct the jury on the law.
Given, but the point I think Judge Schindler is getting at is whether or not the court has an independent duty to edit an instruction that's proposed that may not be entirely correct.
I think it does. I mean, I think it has.
What case law supports that?
Well, I think it has a duty to instruct the jury properly in the law, Your Honor. It's a general obligation on the part of the trial court to give the jury the correct instruction on the law. And here, it gives an incorrect statement of the law by ignoring. Nothing in these instructions the trial court gave give you any flavor of the special relationship or the duty to protect a student under the custodial care of a school district.
But wasn't that up to the
foreseeable harm?
But wasn't that up to the plaintiff to propose an accurate and correct instruction of the duty?
And we argue that it did, but if the court was concerned about the instruction not being perfect, the court could easily deal with this issue by simply striking the language that it found inappropriate and giving the proper instruction on the law.
What do you do with the case law that says that if the instruction proposed is in any way inaccurate, the court doesn't have to give it?
Well, if it was a situation where there was it was a question of whether the instruction was a correct statement of the law versus an issue involving a multiplicity of instructions and the court has a discretion with respect to how it goes about instructing, that would be one thing. Here, we have an incorrect statement of the law. And the incorrect statement of the law, as we've argued, is compounded by the slanting instruction the trial court gave, instruction number 17, on the special duty with respect to mainstreaming the student, and also just a fundamentally wrong statement of contributory fault that allowed the jury to focus, additionally, slanting the argument further, focus inappropriately on the conduct of Mr. Hopkins when he can't consent, in any event, to an assault, any more than the prisoners could consent to an assault in a case like State versus Weber that we've cited to the court. The point is, I wouldn't make this simplistic as an obligation on the part of the trial court to edit, but the trial court has an overarching obligation to correctly instruct the jury on the law. We had an obligation to correctly and properly advise the court what the law was. We believe we did, but if the court thought we didn't, the court could easily remedy that problem by a minor change in the proposed instruction to accomplish it appropriately, or the deletion of instruction number 17, or the deletion of the instructions on contributory fault, and the jury would have been properly instructed. The jury here was not.
On rebuttal, my question is whether you have shown prejudice and were unable to argue your theory of the case, because reading closing argument, the counsel was able to argue and did argue, I think, the theory of the case that they didn't follow the IEP and didn't protect and keep students safe. But I don't want to take your time.
Let me answer that right now, Your Honor, because I think it's important. It was a slanting of the argument. When the court ignores...
Well, I'm talking about plaintiff's argument, closing argument.
Well, I understand
that. They are making that argument.
But the closing argument that the school district had was the opportunity to argue from an instruction in its favor on the mainstreaming issue that we did not have the opportunity to argue from. The jury was not given this special duty, the special custodial relationship to protect Mr. Hopkins from reasonably foreseeable dangers, of which EE was clearly one, and the IEP itself acknowledges that. Thank you.
Okay, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Morning, may it please the court. I'm Jeff Ryman, representing the Seattle School District, the defendant below. Focusing first on the instructions given on the duty of ordinary care that the district owed to the plaintiff, it seems to be that there's some suggestion that that was not an accurate statement of the law. The district's position is that, in fact, that is the duty that is owed by a public school district to students in their custody.
Well, you know, I don't see a duty instruction.
There is a claims instruction that sets forth what the claims are, and that the claim was that the duty was owed to protect.
That's a claim, but the jury shouldn't have to decide the law. I mean, the law is that the school district owes a duty. Whatever that duty is not stated anywhere. The only instruction that is given that looks anything like a duty instruction is instruction 17, which states that the school district's must and is required to educate children with disabilities in the general education environment. So it looks to me like the court did not tell the jury that the school district owed any kind of a duty to the victim. The court did instruct the jury that the school district owed a duty to the assailant. Now, how can you have a tort case where there's no duty instruction?
The court did instruct the jury on what the duty that was owed by the district.
And what is that instruction?
The duty of ordinary care, Your Honor.
I do not see an instruction that says a school district owes a duty of ordinary care to the students in its care.
Well, I think you're right about that. The court did not say the district owes a duty of ordinary care. The court did.
Shouldn't there be an instruction like that? I mean, how can you have a tort case where the elements are duty, breach, causation, and damages, and where the most important instruction is duty, which is always a question of law for the court, and which has been amplified in many, many appellate opinions which are decided on summary judgment, where there's just, you know, a lot of legal thinking devoted to what is the duty owed by various entities, and then not tell the jury what the duty is. If you would have to say, it seems to me, you would have to have an instruction, if your position is correct, there would be an instruction that says, a school district owes a duty of ordinary care to the children in its care. That's your position. And then you would cite to a case that says that.
There's a legion of cases that say that.
They say that that's the only duty that's owed is a duty of ordinary care? And
yeah.
What is the case that says that?
There are several cited by both parties, the McLeod case, more recently the Cope versus Tacoma School District case.
The what?
Cope, K-O-K. There almost every case that addresses alleged negligence by a school district describes that the duty owed is the duty of ordinary care. That duty derives from the special relationship between a school and its students. But the duty is ordinary care.
And does the duty of ordinary care include a duty to protect against foreseeable harms?
Yes.
But that's not in here either, is it?
No, and the WPIs don't recommend that you instruct on foreseeability. I mean, foreseeability is a limitation on the scope of a duty, mm-hmm. which, as you pointed out, is typically a question of law for the court. It was undisputed in this case that the Seattle School District owed a duty of ordinary care. The plaintiff's instructions use that duty. Defense instructions use that same duty. What the plaintiffs asked for is an elaboration as to why it is that the Seattle School District owes that duty of ordinary care. We objected, saying that's not necessary, as in any negligence case, or a typical negligence case, I should say. The standard instruction is the 10.01, 10.02 WPIs, and the trial judge in this case instructed using those standard instructions. It was not an abuse of discretion on their part, and as the cases cited in briefs indicate, it's not error to decline to provide detailed augmenting instructions as to the nature of the duty owed, particularly by personifying that duty to the named defendant. I mean, that's frowned upon. And the trial judge appropriately followed that law and said, no, I'm going to just instruct on the standard WPI instruction.
It's just, you know, is there a case where a case has actually gone to trial and an instruction has been given and the only duty instruction is a duty instruction that says that the school district owes a duty of ordinary care? Without saying to whom it owes it or whether it's to protect or to anything like that. Is there any case like that?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of a negligence case that is a reported appellate decision against a public school district.
Well, or in favor of it, but I'm just talking about, you know, what the instruction that's actually given. I mean, I'm thinking by analogy, too, and, you know, in a car design case, there's the well-worn instruction that a municipality has a duty to design its highways in a manner that is safe for ordinary travel. Now, you could just have a highway design case that starts out, a municipality owes a duty of ordinary care to people on its highways. But that isn't what we do. And the reason why we don't do it as a practical matter is because there's a specific WPI. But the fact that there is or is not a WPI is not the determinative consideration in deciding whether an what instructions are appropriate. It's a helpful, practical consideration, but there are many, many situations, and apparently this is one of them, cases in which students through school districts where there simply has not been a WPI that has been worked out. But nevertheless, it seems to me there should be a duty instruction. A school district owes a duty of ordinary care. Is that all? That's all it is? So a person that goes to school, a child that goes to school and is taken care of by teachers who are standing in loco parentis are no different from somebody that is walking down the street and you have a duty not to bump into them?
Your Honor, that's what the case law in Washington uniformly holds.
Well, no, McLeod.
That's what you think. You think that a school district and the kids that come to school, that your only duty is basically not to get in their way, not to bump into them. You don't have any protective duty.
That's not what McLeod says. I mean, McLeod clearly sets forth a duty to protect students on the school district.
A duty?
From protect the students from anticipated dangers or anticipated harm. That's what McLeod says. McLeod also says, and this is probably where there's some tension, McLeod also says that ordinary standards of negligence will apply. So how do you reconcile what McLeod says about that duty to protect? Because there's nothing in these instructions that tells the jury that the school district has that duty to protect from anticipated dangers.
I reconcile it by saying that duty to protect is the duty to use reasonable care under the same or similar circumstances. That's what McLeod said. That's what all the cases following McLeod have said, that it is a duty of ordinary care. Yes, these children are in the custody of a school district. True. Because they are in the custody of a school district, the school district owes those children a duty of ordinary care to protect them from foreseeable harm.
Now, as I read the record, when the discussion of the jury instructions was going on, you didn't object to, you objected to certain parts of the proposed instructions, but you didn't object to this specific duty that is set forth that is basically taken from McLeod.
I didn't object to the portions of their proposed instructions that recited the WPI.
That's 10.01 and 10.02.
Correct.
But each one of these instructions then goes on to say what there is in McLeod. So did you object to giving an instruction that says that the school district has a duty to reasonably anticipate dangers and protect students in its custody?
I did, Your Honor, and I think the transcript does reflect that I objected to that on the grounds that that was an incomplete statement of the law.
That why is that incomplete? That's exactly what McLeod says.
Because it was, I think, JN versus Bellingham School District that talked about the fact that, let me just find that language here, that you cannot, it's not necessarily anticipated, reasonably anticipated, that a child who engages in minor misconduct will engage in much more severe misconduct, as occurred in this case, where this fellow broke a student's jaw when the prior
that's
incident.
That's a factual argument. And I know that's in one of these proposed instructions, but not 8. Not jury instruction 8. All right, thank you.
If I could just ask you one other question. And a couple of minutes ago, you said that that a school district does have a duty that involves protection of students. You used the word protect.
The duty to use ordinary care would include using reasonable care to protect students from foreseeable harm.
But you object to an instruction that would have the word protect in it.
No, there is an instruction that has that. That's a claims instruction that says that there is a duty to protect.
The claims instruction is not the instruction that states the duty, or do you think it is?
It states what the allegation of negligence is in the case that the jury has to determine by applying the standard of ordinary care.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court in Christensen described this duty as, quote, an enhanced and solemn duty to protect minor students in its care. It's consistent with Briscoe, McLeod, Christensen, Jan, and L. All those cases talk about that. When counsel stands up before the court and says that that idea of protection is reflected in the court's instructions, that's just not true. Look at instruction number 5, look at instruction number 8. Nowhere is the term protection mentioned anyplace. And moreover, following along Judge Becker's questions, nowhere is there an indication that the district owes a duty to anybody. The instruction number 9 simply describes what negligence is in very general terms without saying the district has the duty to do that. The closest thing there is to something that suggests protection is instruction number 5, where among the contentions, first contention, is that of the plaintiff that the district was negligent in failing to prevent EE from assaulting plaintiff. But there's nothing that speaks to this enhanced duty, nothing that speaks to a duty on the part of the Seattle School District to protect the students within its charge. Error in the instruction. But the error is then compounded by the argument about mainstreaming EE. And I heard counsel to say as he was standing before the court that this, you know, what we were asking for was an elaboration as to why the district owed a duty of care to Mr. Hopkins. But then why is instruction number 17 on mainstreaming appropriate? It's an elaboration on the district's duty of with respect to mainstreaming EE. There is absolutely nothing that indicates that elaboration on the part of the district's duty to EE is relevant at all to the question of whether the district should be negligent for allowing this assault to occur on Mr. Hopkins. It is a detail augmenting instruction by which the trial court put its thumb on the scale and slanted the instructions to the jury. Lastly, I heard nothing from counsel with respect to the contributory fault issue, a further slanting of the issue. We believe it was inappropriate. We believe if the court reverses, it's an issue that's appropriate on remand. But it is a slanting. It forced the jury to look at the fault, so-called fault of Mr. Hopkins when he could not consent to an assault in this context. For these reasons, we believe a new trial is appropriate. Thank you.